All right, tonight we are in Exodus 12, and we are going to finally consider the Exodus of Israel out of Egypt. When we were together a few weeks ago, two times ago, we contemplated the 10th plague, the destruction of the firstborn of Egypt, and that was in Exodus chapter 12. And 29 through 32 is where that particular piece of the narrative finished up. The last time we were together, we focused not on death, but we focused on life and salvation, and we contemplated the Passover. So at the beginning of Exodus 12, verses 1 through 13, there was the Passover lamb that God, through Moses, commanded the Israelites to kill on the eve of the Exodus. And when they killed that lamb, that unblemished lamb, and then they spread the blood on the door jams of their homes, then when the angel of death came to kill the firstborn, all the firstborn in Egypt, not just the Egyptians, but the Israelites as well, when the angel of death came through and saw the blood on the door jams, then he would pass over that particular house and spare the firstborn of the Israelites. In verses 14 through 28, and then also at the end of the chapter 42 through 51, that's where we were last time, also talking about the recurring feast of the Passover, which was one of the most important feasts in the Israelite year. And so there are stipulations for that, and we will mention some of those things again here tonight. But as you can see in Exodus chapter 12, verse 14, as God is instructing the Israelites to celebrate the Passover every year, he says, "Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord. Throughout your generations, you are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance," or an eternal ordinance. And so this is very important to God, that his people would celebrate the Passover on an annual basis, and they would remember, by celebrating the Passover, they would remember. It was an eight-day feast. They would remember God's great deliverance of the Israelite people out of Egypt, where the nation Israel was literally born. Okay, that's what the Exodus is all about, as we're headed through the book of Exodus here. Now, today, we're just going to consider verses 33 to 41. There's only nine verses there. But we're going to talk then a little bit, as I've been advertising, about some math at the end. And we're going to talk about how long, in fact, the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt. All right? And so it takes a little bit of work to do that. I've got some handouts, and I'll give those to you in a second. But let's pick up in verse 33. So this is after after the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians. Okay, that's where we're picking up, verse 33. "The Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, 'We shall all be dead.' So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls bound up and clothes on their shoulders. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. And a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. And they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened, since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years, and it came about at the end of 430 years, to the very day, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." All right, so as we go through here, want to remember a couple of things. So way, 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 way back in Exodus chapter 3, if you'll go there with me briefly, Exodus chapter 3, At the beginning of Exodus chapter 3, there's the account of the burning bush. This is where God gives Moses his covenant name, Yahweh, as we've been saying. And then in verses 10 through the end of the chapter, Moses is given his mission to go back to Egypt and to be the leader of the Israelites as they are brought out of Egypt and saved from their slavery. And as we go through here, I want you to see, let me pick up in verse 16 of Exodus chapter 3. God says to Moses, "Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, that is Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will pay heed to what you say. And you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, The Lord, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it, and after that he will let you go. Verse 21, and I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians." So God has already told Moses how it's going to go down, right? Which now we have seen over the last several times we've been together through the 10 plagues and everything that Pharaoh resisted every single time. God brings the 10 plagues upon him, and now, according to what God had told Moses was going to happen, on the eve of the Exodus, after the angel of death has gone through and killed all the firstborn of Egypt, now the women, back in Exodus chapter 12, they ask from the Egyptians, verse 35, for articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, just as God had predicted. And of course, the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, verse 36 of Exodus 12, so that they let them have their request. Thus, they plundered the Egyptians. And if you remember at the time, we talked about this plundering, right? At the end of the day, the Israelites had been enslaved in Egypt for quite some time. That's about as general as it can get at this point, because we'll get to the details later. But the Israelites had been enslaved in Egypt for quite some time. And so what we talked about at that time was this plundering was basically a recompense for all of those years where the Israelites were in bondage and working for essentially nothing under the hand of Pharaoh in Egypt. Right? So God's promise and prophecy comes to fulfillment here on the eve of the Exodus. Verse 37. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. So there, if you read the commentaries, there is a lot of challenging to this number of 600,000 men on foot. The question is, you know, could the Israelites have gotten this big this fast? I mean, if you think about 600,000 men, and then you add in the women and the children, right, we're talking about a big number. We're talking about maybe a couple of million people here, right? And the truth, and sometimes the commentaries will say that really what they're talking about is clans and tribes, and it's not as big, and some of the estimates are actually quite small. But the reality of the situation is, again, I'm not going to do that particular math for you here tonight, but if you do the math, it's actually not difficult to create this many people this quickly if you have, number one, the blessing of God, okay? And number two, if you have a people group that is generally sequestered in the land of Goshen, right? So there's not much to do, right? Because they're in Egypt, and they're not mingling with the Egyptians too much. So, you know, you can do the math yourselves about husband and wives. If there's not much else to do, you know, maybe this is what they do. And they have kids. That's what they do, right? And so it's actually not really that difficult to get to this number. And so I don't think you need to be so skeptical about this number. I think it was a big number. It's not, you know, out of the realm of possibility. I have no reason to argue for it. And in fact, if you go on, if you're doing your Bible reading through the year, then by this time you've already gotten into maybe Leviticus and Numbers, and you will see that there are real counts there. There is literally, the book of Numbers is called the book of Numbers because there's a census in there. And they're literally taking counts of the people, especially the men aged 20 and above, who are ready for battle as they head west into Canaan, right? So I don't think this is a big deal. I would just believe the number as it's written. Verse 38, and a mixed multitude also went up with them. Now, this is very important. As we, all through the Bible, I've made the case before that for the most part, from Exodus 20 to the book of Malachi, God, it's obvious that God has his focus on the nation of Israel. Okay, all the prophets, not all the prophets, the overwhelming majority of the prophets were to the Israelites. You can't name too many Gentiles that are even mentioned, let alone saved as part of the Old Testament, right? So God has fixed his love on Israel, the apple of his eye. All right. However, the exceptions prove the rule, in that you will find occasionally in the Old Testament, maybe a handful of times, a Gentile who is chosen by God for salvation, right? I think of people like Naaman, who has to go wash seven times in the River Jordan. And you think of Jonah, who actually was a prophet to the Ninevites, right, in Assyria, right? And so you see these little spots in the Old Testament of where there's these sort of birth pangs, if you will, of God going to the Gentiles for his specific purposes. And here we have that. And we already had some echoes of this. So if you would, go back with me to Exodus chapter 9. Exodus chapter 9. In the account of the seventh plague, which was the plague of hail, which picks up in verse 13 of Exodus chapter 9. There's something very important that happens. I don't want to pick up in verse 13. I want to pick up in verse 18 just in the interest of time. Under the plague number 7, the plague of hail. Exodus chapter 9, verse 18. Behold, about this time tomorrow, I will send a very heavy hail, such as has not been seen in Egypt from the day it was founded until now. Now therefore send, bring your livestock and whatever you have in the field to safety. Every man and beast that is found in the field and is not brought home, when the hail comes down on them, will die. Verse 20. The one among the servants of Pharaoh who feared the word of the Lord made his servants and his livestock flee into the houses. But he who paid no regard to the word of the Lord left his servants and his livestock in the field. So we do see that even at the highest levels, even at the highest levels of the household of Pharaoh, there were Egyptians who were now starting to believe after six plagues that this God, Yahweh, means business. All right? And it doesn't take, a rocket scientist to figure out, hey, if God's people are getting out of town, I'm going with them. All right? And so we see the echoes of that in Exodus 9. And that's exactly what's being alluded to here in Exodus 12, verse 38. This mixed multitude. And the other place we saw that was the last time we were together and we were reading the stipulations for the Feast of Passover. Here's what we read in verse 48 of Exodus 12. But if a stranger sojourns with you and celebrates the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near to celebrate it. And he shall be like a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person may eat of it. So what we're seeing here, right, is that God knows that some of these Egyptians are being drawn. And so what he does is he provides a stipulation in the law of Israel for what we would call proselytes, converts, Gentile converts to the Israelite nation to come in to literally become Israelites. And the way you become an Israelite is you become circumcised, all the males in your household, yourself and all your males, your sons and your male servants. That brings you into the nation of Israel. And then you are free to celebrate the Passover as a remembrance of what God did for the mixed multitude. as we see in verse 38. And then, if you remember, Pastor Mike, at the beginning of when he was preaching through the Gospel of John, over the years, this concept of proselyte got much more complex, and there was the mikvah bath and these things, these ritual ceremonies that Gentiles would have to undergo in order to come into the Israelite nation. All right, but what we see, even from the very birth of the nation of Israel, is that God has made a way for Gentiles to come into the nation of Israel to worship the one true God. And you can see that. You can see that with Ruth, right, who is a Moabitess. She's not a native Israelite, but she is willing. She says to Naomi, right, your God is my God. Right? Your people are my people, right? So she comes in as a non-Israelite, right? And she's very important, obviously, in the lineage of Jesus, right? And so we see these, again, little echoes of these things as the gospel going out to the Gentiles. Obviously, in Acts chapter 2, that's where that whole thing just explodes, right? In the tongues of fire and the speaking in tongues and the gospel going to all nations. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay, here we go. All right, so I have a handout. So the question, let's see, is that all I wanted to say? Yeah, so in verse 40, now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord Yahweh went out from the land of Egypt. So, the question is this. How long were the Israelites in Egypt? So on your handout, which I'm going to try and also make available as part of this sermon audio recording, on your handout, I begin with the four important texts that we have to consider as we're coming through the answer to this question. All right? It may seem to you like the obvious answer is something like 400 years, okay? But there are some subtleties here that we have to understand. So here are the four texts that are relevant to our discussion tonight. In Genesis 15:13, so you remember Genesis 15 is this great chapter, the covenant-cutting ceremony with Abraham. Okay, Abraham cuts the animals in half, and then God puts him to sleep, and then the flaming torch passes through. Right, very, very important chapter. We were there, many, many moons ago. Genesis 15:13. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years." We've read that. We've looked at that in the past. Exodus 12, 40 and 41, which we just read, but let's read again just for completeness sake. The time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, on that very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. So, in Genesis 15, 13, we have 400 years. In Exodus 12, we have 430 years. It gets more fun. Stick with me. Acts 7, verse 6. So Acts 7, which we're now through on Sunday mornings, is Stephen's extended defense before the Jewish council. All right. At the end of it, it goes poorly for him, except he sees Jesus, which sounds pretty awesome. Okay. But anyway, he gets stoned at the end of that. But in the course of his defense before the Sanhedrin, he says in Acts chapter 7, verse 6, "And God spoke to this effect." So he's recounting biblical history. That's what he's doing. "And God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others, who would enslave them and afflict them 400 years. So what he's doing here is he is hearkening back to Genesis chapter 15 and the covenant cutting ceremony with Abram. And then in Galatians 3, 16 and 17, Paul writes this. "Now the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring," or his seed, depending on which translation you're reading. It does not say, "and to offsprings," or seeds, referring to many, but referring to one, "and to your offspring," or seed, who is Christ. Verse 17, "This is what I mean. The law, which came 430 years afterward, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God so as to make the promise void. So, Paul is saying that the law, which is Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, which came very soon after the Exodus, came 430 years after God made this specific promise to Abraham, that is, and to your seed, I will give this land. All right? So these, so that we had two 400s and two 430s. And this is a little foreshadowing. The answer to the question at the top of your sheet is neither. Is neither. Okay? So let's walk through this. Was it 400 or 430 or something else? I just want to walk you through the chronology that we have already seen, right? It takes some time to put it together. I did not do this independently. I checked other sources for the same types of calculations, but I did the calculation myself, all right? And I had some people at Vettis check it as well, right? What's awesome about this as we head in to this discussion is that the Bible provides all of a sufficient amount of detail to answer this question. You just have to be willing to piece it together. Okay? So, in Genesis chapter 12, Abraham, his name is Abram at the time, Abraham is 75 years old. And what happens in that chapter is that God makes his first promise to Abraham, who leaves Haran and he travels southwest into Canaan. And he also spends a short amount of time, if you remember, in Egypt. Right? He goes down to Egypt, right? This isn't my wife, this is my sister. You remember the whole episode. Okay? And according to Galatians 3:17, the law came 430 years after the promises given to Abraham in Genesis 12. That's where the promise is, and to your seed. In Genesis, from Abraham being 75 to 85, God tells Abraham that his descendants will be sojourners, bless you, in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there and will be afflicted for 400 years. So you can read this, Genesis 15:13. And Acts chapter 7, verse 6. And when Abraham is 85 years old, he's lived in Canaan for 10 years. And because the promise of a son, that he would be given a son, is taking too long, you remember, Sarah offers her maidservant, Hagar, to Abraham. And Abraham goes in and Hagar conceives Ishmael. This is when Abraham is 85 years old. Genesis 16, 3 and 4. This is, now as I'm counting down, the right-hand column is counting down from 430. Okay? This is 10 years later. Abraham is 86. Ishmael is born. All right? 11 years from the promise. You can read this in Genesis 16, 15 and 16. From Genesis 21... Abraham is 100 years old and Ishmael is 14 years old. Isaac, the son of promise, is born. All right? And so this is 25 years after the original promise. Abraham at 105, Ishmael at 19, Isaac at 5. Isaac is weaned, and this is very important. Isaac is weaned and Ishmael mocks Isaac. Ishmael mocks Isaac. And you can read about this in Genesis chapter 21, 8 and 9. This is 30 years after the Genesis 12 promise. And the reason that's significant is because the difference between 430 and 400 is 30. This is a very significant event in the biblical redemptive story. Everybody with me so far? Mm-hmm. Just reading down the sheet. When Abraham is 140, Isaac is 40, Isaac marries Rebekah. You can read about this in Genesis chapter 24. Abraham is 160, Isaac is 60, Esau and Jacob are born. This is in Genesis 25, 26, and I put the references there so you can go through and just check them for yourself. Abraham is 175, Isaac is 75, Jacob is 15. This is when Abraham dies. All right. So Jacob is born before Abraham dies. Very interesting. All right. And this is exactly 100 years after the original promise of Genesis chapter 12. If you turn the sheet over. Now, this is a tough one because this information is not explicitly in the text. You actually have to back it out from later texts, okay? But when Isaac is 151 years old and Jacob is 91, Joseph is born. Joseph is born. So Jacob is pretty well on in years, right? But it says that Joseph is the son of his old age, Joseph and Benjamin, right? He's his favorite, okay? And so this is 176 years after the original promise. In Genesis 37, Isaac is 168, Jacob is 108, and Joseph is 17. Joseph is sold by his brothers and taken to Egypt. In Genesis 35, Isaac is 180, Jacob 120, Joseph is 29. Isaac dies. So it's interesting. Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers while Isaac is still alive. Okay? Which wasn't abundantly obvious to us back when we were going through Genesis. Okay? Genesis 41. Jacob is 121 years old and Joseph is 30 years of age and he's made the vice president of Egypt. This is 206 years after the original Genesis 12 promise. In Genesis 45 and Genesis 47, Jacob is 130, Joseph is 39. And this is when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers 2 years into the seven-year famine. If you remember, there were 7 years of plenty. Right?
Seven years of famine,
and 2 years in, that's when Jacob comes down from Israel, Jacob's sons, and Joseph reveals himself to Jacob's mm-hmm. sons, and then Joseph goes and retrieves Jacob, and Jacob comes down into Egypt. That's 215 years after the original promise made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. 215 is exactly half of 430. When Jacob is 147, Joseph is 56, Jacob dies. You can read about that in Genesis 47 to 49. And then in Genesis 50, verse 26, Joseph is 110 and he dies. That's 286 years after the original promise in Genesis chapter 12. All right? Then in between Genesis and Exodus, there's some amount of time, which we don't know. It turns out that if you work backwards from the last two pieces of information, you can calculate that the time between the end of Genesis, where Joseph dies, and the beginning of Exodus, where Moses is born, was 64 years. 64 years. Moses is 3 months old. You can read about this in Exodus. Oh, and there's something interesting. In Exodus chapter 6, you see the reference I have there? In Exodus chapter 6, it's very interesting, and I'll bring this up again in a second, but it's very interesting because it gives the lineage from Levi, who is Jacob's third son, to Moses and Aaron. And there's only three generations from Levi to Moses and Aaron. Moses, when he's 3 months, he's placed in a basket and adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. Moses is nursed by his mother at Pharaoh's daughter's request. This is in Exodus chapter 2. This is 350 years after the original promise. And then when Moses is 80 years old, so he spends his first 40 years as a son of Egypt. He spends his second 40 years, right, being a shepherd, tending the flocks of his father-in-law Jethro in the land of Midian. And then his last 40 years, he's leading the Israelites through the wilderness. So Moses' life comes in three sets of 40. So when he's 80 years old, that's when they are called, God calls Moses and Aaron to confront Pharaoh and ultimately lead the Israelites out of Egypt. And that is 430 years after the promise. And we know that because Paul says that the law came 430 years after the promise made to Abraham. All right? So, the truth is that the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt for somewhere between, we know it's got to be more than 80 because that's how old Moses was. And by when Moses was born, they were already slaves. Okay? But it has to be less than 144 because we know that 80 plus 64 is 64 years before that, Joseph died. And Joseph was the vice president. And so it's interesting because in Exodus 1, it says that when a new Pharaoh came along who didn't know Joseph, right? When he came along, he put the Israelites into slavery. And it turns out that was somewhere between 144 years before the Exodus and 80 years. Okay? So, reasonably speaking, they were probably enslaved in Egypt for something like 120 years. And I confess, I'm thinking, I didn't do this, but if you go back to the beginning of this Exodus series, I probably threw out the number 400 very flippantly before I went through this exercise, okay? And the answer really, truly is, it's a little bit more than a century. Now, that's a long time. I'm not saying that's not a long time for a people to be enslaved and to live and to die, and there's two or three generations in there. I'm not saying it's not a long time, all right? Now, this is, so what's the point? Let's go through these bullet points and then we'll go through a little bit of the controversy because this is a little bit controversial. So the affliction of Abraham's offspring predicted in 15:13. So if you turn it over and look at Genesis 15:13. Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. The question is, when does that affliction start? Look at your timeline. When does the affliction of Abraham's offspring begin? When Ishmael mocks Isaac. That's exactly 400 years before the Exodus. So the affliction of Abraham's offspring begins when Ishmael laughs at Isaac. The 400-year clock starts. Okay? The 430 years that the people of Israel lived in Egypt began when Abraham went to Egypt, right after he was called by God to leave Haran. When Abraham goes into Egypt, the 430-year clock starts. And exactly 30 years later, Ishmael mocks Isaac. That's where your 30-year difference comes from. Okay? Stephen, in Acts 7, bears witness to the 400-year affliction and enslavement of Abraham's offspring, which began when Isaac was mocked by Ishmael. And the Apostle Paul bears witness to the Mosaic Law, Exodus 20, coming 430 years after God made his original promise to Abraham in Genesis 12. So the number of consecutive years that Israel, that includes Jacob, literally the man Israel, mm-hmm. and his sons are in Egypt prior to the Exodus is 215. And the enslavement is probably something more like 120. Okay, now, here's the controversy. Not all the commentators agree on this. Okay, not all the commentators agree. So let me give you a sense of a commentator, and it's not the only one. okay? But a commentator who disagrees with what I just told you, okay? So this particular commentator says this. The chronological statement in Exodus chapter 12, verse 40, is not only in harmony with the prediction of Genesis 15, 13, where the round number is employed in prophetic style, but may be reconciled with the different genealogical lists if we only bear in mind, now listen, if we only bear in mind that the genealogies do not always contain a complete enumeration of all the separate links, but very frequently intermediate links of little historical importance are omitted. Okay? So here's the argument against what I just told you. Mm-hmm. The argument is twofold. Number one, in Genesis 15, 13, and in Acts 7, 6, when God speaks to Moses and Stephen speaks before the Sanhedrin and he uses the word the term 400 or the number 400, they were just rounding. 400 is like 430. Okay? Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that there's not occasionally rounding going on in the Bible. There is. For example, in Exodus chapter 12, verse 37, now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot. Okay? So there's clearly rounding going on occasionally. Okay? If we look at this 70-year exile, right? Depending on how you calculate that, it could be exactly 70, it could be as many as 85. Okay? The point is, there's rounding going on. I got no issue with that. All right? But that's the first part of the argument against what I just told you, is that 400 and 430, they're about the same, and it takes a lot of energy to say 30. Okay? So that's the first argument. All right? The second argument is to the genealogies. This commentator acknowledges that in Exodus 6, there's only three generations between Levi and Moses and Aaron. He acknowledges that and literally says that the way we account for the larger time that the Israelites are in Egypt is, well, we know that in some genealogies, unimportant people are skipped. Again, I don't argue with that. In Matthew chapter 1, it's not a problem for me to say there are a couple of people that are skipped in the genealogy of Jesus. I've got no issue with that. That's relatively well known, right? You can go read commentaries, right? Because what Matthew's trying to do is he's trying to give his Jewish hearers a way to remember that it was 14 generations, 14 generations, 14 generations. Okay? So I don't have any issue with the idea that occasionally in genealogies, people get skipped in the Bible. But not this time. Not this time. All right? So that's the twofold argument against this. You will read that in commentaries. Sometimes you'll read it in your study Bible notes. Okay? Here's what I want to say. Here's the reason why I believe this is the right thing. Okay? I believe it's the right thing for two arguments. Two arguments. The first one I want to give you is that in your Bibles, the Old Testament translation that you have in English is based on what's called the Hebrew Masoretic Text. Okay? The Hebrew Masoretic Text. The Hebrew Masoretic Text, when you translate Exodus chapter 12, verse 40 into English from the Hebrew Masoretic Text, it literally reads, "Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years." That seems straightforward. In the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, and in the Samaritan Pentateuch, that is, so if you remember in John chapter 4, Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well, and then they start arguing. What's the first thing they argue about? It's not her husband's, it's what? Where's the right place to worship God? Do you remember that? If you go back to John chapter 4, she gets into this theological argument with this Jewish rabbi who's sitting down by a well. Right? It turns out that the Samaritans, they did not accept the entire Old Testament as their scriptures. They only accepted the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, and they had their own translation. It's called the Samaritan Pentateuch. I have a translation of Exodus chapter 12 of the Samaritan Pentateuch right here. And just so happens I also have a translation of the Septuagint here. Here's what Exodus chapter 12, verse 40 says in the Septuagint. Okay, so let's re-familiarize ourselves. This is what your Bible says, Exodus 12, verse 40 says. At the time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. Okay? This is what the Septuagint says. Now the residents of the sons of Israel, during which they dwelt in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, was 430 years. Do you see the difference? And the Samaritan Pentateuch says, Exodus chapter 12, verse 40, now the sojourning of the children of Israel and the fathers of them who dwelt in Canaan and in Egypt was 430 years. In Galatians 3:17, Paul is appealing to the Septuagint. The Hebrew Masoretic text, right? And if you have questions about this, we can talk about it afterward. But the Hebrew Masoretic text does not have the preposition.
I said, oh boy.
Yeah.
Can we ever?
Okay. These are things that Pastor Mike has studied extensively, and I've studied not as extensively, but done a lot of reading. Okay. The Hebrew Masoretic text from which your English translation is derived does not have the extra prepositional phrase "and in the land of Canaan." And on top of that, so that's argument number one. I have Old Testament texts, very reliable Old Testament texts that have "and in Canaan." Okay, and again, we can talk about the differences between those texts if you'd like, probably after the recording goes off, right? That's argument number one. Argument number two is the following. I can find some pretty reliable commentators that agree with me. Okay? So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, here's what they say. The Septuagint renders it this. The sojourning of the children and of their fathers, which they sojourn in the land of Canaan and in the land of Egypt. These additions are important, for the period of sojourn in Egypt did not exceed 215 years. But if we reckon from the time that Abraham entered Canaan and the promise was made in which the sojourn of his posterity in Egypt was announced, this makes up the time 430 years. John Gill, very famous Baptist who wrote a commentary on the entire Bible, talks about the Septuagint and the Samaritan Pentateuch. And he says, and certain it is that Israel did not dwell in Egypt 430 years and even not much more than 200 years. From thence to the coming of Israel out of Egypt were 210 years as is generally computed. I would take a little bit of issue with his calculation. I think he's 5 years off. Okay? But he's just making the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And appealing to the Septuagint and to the Samaritan Pentateuch based on Paul's authoritative statement in Galatians 3. The treasury of scriptural knowledge. The Samaritan Pentateuch reads, now the sojourning, and I'm not going to read it to you, but I have it right here, right? It is evidence that the descendants of Israel did not dwell 430 years in Egypt, while it is equally evident that the period from Abraham's entry into Canaan to the Exodus is exactly that number. And Matthew Henry, who doesn't appeal to Matthew Henry's commentary on the entire Bible, he says this, speaking of the Exodus, of the date of this great event, it was just 430 years from the promise made to Abraham, as the apostle explains it, Galatians 3:17, at his first coming into Canaan, during all which time the children of Israel, that is the Hebrews, the distinguished chosen seed, were sojourners in a land that was not theirs, either Canaan or Egypt. The first day of the march of Abraham's seed towards Canaan was just 430 years, it should seem to a day, from the promise made to Abraham, Genesis 12, 2, I will make of thee a great nation. Okay? So, it seems, and Matthew Henry also says, at the end of 400 years, that was, by the way, his commentary on Exodus 12, 40. If you go to Acts 7, verse 6, and read Matthew Henry's commentary with regard to the 400 years that Stephen mentions in Acts chapter 7, verse 6, Matthew Henry says this, and at the end of 400 years, quoting Acts 7, verse 6, he says, reckoning from the birth of Isaac. I would argue it's the weaning of Isaac, but we're just arguing about 5 years at that point. All right. So the two lines of argumentation are that I have reliable Old Testament texts that were authoritative in the time of the apostles and some pretty hefty, reliable commentaries. Okay? And so all of that to say, if you forget all of this, that's totally okay with me. All right? But all of that to say a couple of things. Number one, the Bible is not mythology. It has all of these details literally down to a year. The year. Right? People who write myths don't have this level of detail in them. Right? God, as soon as he calls Abraham, he starts the clock. And 430 years to the day, he fulfills that promise to rescue his people out of slavery. And as we will go on to see, that rescue of the Israelites out of the slavery of Egypt is a picture of the salvation that we have in and through his Son, Jesus Christ. And so we can be as confident in the great promises that God has given to us in places like Romans 8, because we look back and we see that God fulfills his promises to Abraham 430 years to the day, just like he promised him. And this should be an encouragement to us. It's not mythology. This is redemptive history. This is the sure foundation of our faith and our hope. Amen.
Amen.